And in the middle of that tune, Bela Fleck. How you doing, Bela?
Hey, man. How's it going?
Doing good. I know you're very busy, and we were just chatting off the air there about fatherhood and a five-week-old. That's just an amazing time. Congratulations so much to you, and you're going to enjoy it.
Thank you. Yeah, we're having a great time with it. And it's, luckily, I was in a position to take this time off. So I have like 3 months of reacclimation time, and then when I get done with that time with Juno and my wife Abigail, we're gonna go on tour, start playing music together as a duo/trio.
Well, I guess you got to take the baby with you.
Yes, yeah, exactly. Man. Well, that was the whole point. Is my wife Abigail Washburn is a touring musician as well, so much of the time normally we're apart, you know. So now with this new paradigm with this baby, we're trying to figure out creative ways to be together, and one of our favorites is to actually play music together, which we love to do anyway.
Now, you traveled with, the Sparrow Quintet here not long ago.
Yeah, that was maybe 5 years ago, maybe even longer.
Really?
Time is flying by.
Jeez, oh, Pete. I thought that was last year.
Oh, I think it's been at least 4 years, maybe six. Okay. I'm not sure. Okay. We'll have to check that. Check. Maybe someone can call in.
As a matter of fact, well, they will. So there's a chat room, and every time I get something wrong, everybody types in there and says this is wrong. Oh, by the way, folks, if you're trying to get in the chat room in the middle of the last set of music, Mark Horowitz called in, and he cannot get in the chat room. He wanted to come in to be available to shoot questions off to Bela Fleck, and Mark Horowitz is saying that the chat room is having difficulties. If people listening are having difficulties, I apologize. There's nothing I can do about it here except cross my fingers and hope that it clears up. But Mark wanted to be around to shoot questions to you, Bela, so there.
Mark's a good dude. He was my second banjo teacher, and he taught me an immense amount of banjo music. And he's one of those guys that has encyclopedic knowledge of all the banjo playing to date. At least he did back then. I'm sure he still does.
Oh, he does.
And if I wanted to know what Alan Mundy did, what Bobby Thompson did, what Bill Keith did, what Tony Trischka did, everybody, he could demonstrate it for me or figure it out by the next lesson.
Mark is he's a regular caller. He really is. He calls in all the time and just shares whatever knowledge. And it's funny that he called. I'm not making this up. The second before he called, I was just kind of, I've sprinkled a lot of your stuff throughout the program, and I have other things to talk about that I haven't played, but just without you being online, I had queued up, no lie, Twisted Teen.
Oh, right, which he recorded in his house.
That's right.
Right.
Yeah, I love that story. He's told me about it before, and I thought, well, it is a cool tune, but he's told me before about the whole tune of Twisted Teen is off of an album that you and Tony Trischka put together. Was it called Solo Nights?
Yeah, exactly what it was. We both wanted to do solo albums, and Rounder wasn't too strong on the idea. They didn't think anybody was going to buy a solo banjo record. So we said, well, what about if we do our solo record together? And then we'll have the two names together to help move it. And they said, maybe in that case. So we did this album called Solo Banjo Works. And halfway through the album, we did a duet that sort of traded handed the torch over. And so I had half an album to fill up, and I came up with a bunch of stuff to do. But then I was going through these old tapes, and I thought, wow, I wonder if there's something from that recording. Because that's the first real recording of my music that was ever done, was Mark on his... I don't know what the machine was. If he was online, we could find out. But just playing at his house when I came in to visit him. And he was always frustrated that some of the stuff on that recording he made of me wasn't on my first record, or that my first record didn't sort of reveal the promise that he felt I had, although I think he felt a lot better about the second album. But anyway, it was neat to pull this thing out. And I might even have been on cassette.
I think it was. Uh-huh. He's told me the name of the machine, but it was just like your regular, tape recorder that he had. Because I don't think at the time, well, you weren't trying to record an album. You were a student, and you were just recording stuff that came to you.
Yeah, I was playing all my new stuff I was working on, some solo tunes, and he said, let me take this. And he did, and it was a good decision, because we were able to pull that track from there.
Yeah, is that as you recorded it, or did you change it around, or...?
If I did, it wasn't much, okay. Because I'm sure I only played it once or twice. Yeah. And maybe if there was a mistake, I might have being a tweaky kind of individual that I am, and digital editing being so easy, it's possible I could have moved a couple of notes around. Yeah. But it's essentially what I played. You know, maybe there might have been one flub that I replaced with the same notes. But I don't even remember. It might have been all original. I just know that that's my tendency, because I work so hard on my playing all the time that when I have an easy opportunity to get rid of a mistake, I can't stop myself, even though I'm fully aware of the fact that it's often a lot more fun to listen to a musician make mistakes and be imperfect. The quest for perfection is so ingrained in me that it's hard to resist an easy fix. So it's possible that I did some editing, but I can't really remember at this point.
All right. He's very proud of the fact that he gets engineering credit.
Oh, yeah. He did. Yeah. Also, it was a tune I had forgotten all about. That's another nice thing about it. I didn't even know I'd written that tune by the time that tape resurfaced. So there's some other stuff on there, too, that's forgotten.
Speaking of recordings, you have a new recording coming out. Now, let me just tell you this, too. I'm looking at my screen on Facebook, and I just kind of mess around, do some advertising or at least promotion of this show on there. And I put up earlier, halfway through the day, I put up a banner that advertises Bela Fleck, The Imposter, with your new album coming out. And let me just tell you this. You could probably just sell that album cover with nothing in it, because the response has been, I mean, every time I look over, I have like 10 or 15 more responses where I think people just like the picture. Do you actually put music in, or are you just going to sell that album art?
Now, where did you get that? Because I didn't think that was released yet. Or that there was any artwork out yet. Is it a picture of an elephant?
It's an elephant with a balloon, yeah.
Yeah, held up a balloon, yeah. Well, that's cool. I don't know how that got out, because we're just finishing the album cover this weekend, and it's supposed to, you know, we're finishing up the album package, but these mysteries abound, and I'm sure that people just get the word out up front.
Well, so
the project is the banjo concerto that I wrote. Go on. I'm sorry, I'm interrupting.
No, I'll tell you how I got it. It was real complicated. I went to Google Images, so it's not a big secret. And that's all there is to it. And then I typed in imposter, and there it was.
You're kidding.
That's it, man. I guess you gotta get the NSA on this, because someone's leaking vital information out of your camp.
That's weird. I'm definitely gonna tell my record label that happened, because that's not supposed to happen.
Well, okay, well, in that case, everybody who has seen my Facebook cover, just forget it right now. Ignore that it's happened. So I was gonna ask you about the balloon on the elephant, though, but we don't have to talk about that if it's not official yet.
No, it's fine. I mean, I'm very proud of this album. I've been working on it probably harder than anything I've ever done, because writing a piece for banjo and orchestra, an 80 piece, I mean, I'm still guessing at that number 80. I think it's 80 pieces. It took the better part of a year to write, and then we had to perform it and get a great recording of it. And then after that, I went to work on writing another piece, because that was about a 35-minute piece. And that wasn't long enough for a whole album, so I wrote another 25-minute piece for banjo and string quartet, and that probably took me 5 months to write. And then there's the editing process of, you know, completing these records, and also a documentary I've been working on that tells the whole story. But it's been a long process. I'm really proud of it.
Did you perform this live recently in Nashville?
I played the concerto in Nashville. The premiere was almost 2 years ago.
Yeah.
It's taken this long to get the stuff done, completed, get the next piece written, and get everything all done. But it's turned out great. And it's coming out on literally the premier classical label, which is pretty amazing, considering I am an imposter. And then that's where the title makes sense, because, you know, I don't know how to write a concerto, but I just decided I'm going to do this. And you know, hopefully nobody will unmask me before the record comes out and sells 10 million records.
Oh, let's hope so. You may have just unmasked yourself, but that's okay. They'll forget that. Well, can I ask you about the album art? I do want to talk about the music, but when I see an elephant floating around with a balloon, I don't know.
I was looking for something whimsical because, you know, how serious can a banjo concerto be? But, of course, I am deadly serious about music, but the truth is, I am coming at this from outside of the classical world, and I'm doing it because I love these kinds of challenges, and I love music and getting forced to figure out how to write and conceive of music for such a large group was a large and elegant group, as an orchestra, and finding a place for the banjo to fit into that was just such an exciting challenge. But that being said, there is a Bach out there, there is a Beethoven out there, a Mozart, there's a Debussy. You know, the level of these guys is so ridiculous, and the output that these guys do. So you know, I put out a banjo concerto, even if it goes pretty well, I know where I stand. You know what I mean? Because these people put out piece after amazing piece throughout their lives, and I don't have time to even get close. But I hope to do something worthwhile. And I feel like I did, and I hope that people feel that way about it. And I do think it's something that hasn't been out there before.
Out of all of the types of music that you've seriously dipped your foot into, and more than that, I mean, I have records from McCoy Tyner where you're sneaking on there. It's a guitar album, by the way, Bela. And then in the middle, there's a couple banjo pieces. McCoy Tyner and guitars, and there's Bela Fleck on a banjo.
Yeah, those people didn't know that wasn't a guitar. Isn't that amazing?
I played it on a jazz radio station that I have, and let me tell you this, everybody knew it after I played it.
Yeah, I'm sure the hate mail came in.
Nah.
Got it. It was a neat thing, you know. I think they were just choosing collaborators for McCoy, and they wanted to find people that would challenge him or interest him.
Well,
and luckily they thought I would, and we had a great time doing that.
I want to ask you about McCoy Tyner, but the point that I bring that up is I want to ask how you got the mindset to want to write this concerto. But first let me ask you about and you've recorded with, I mean, and you're a world-class musician. You've been with Edgar Meyer, you've been with all those great players throughout the years. Not, I don't mean just to drop classical names, but when you're in a recording studio with McCoy Tyner, that has to give you even a tingle, doesn't it?
Yeah, are you kidding? I mean, I go from one amazing situation to another, and you know, Edgar's a guy that I started working with so early that he doesn't intimidate me mostly. But, you know, on that album that we did,
sure.
He helped me make the classical album. I was out there with, you know, with Joshua Bell and Evelyn Glennie, John Williams, all these amazing heavyweight guys. But then, you know, now I'm touring as a duo with Chick Corea.
Yeah.
And to me, that's even more intimidating than McCoy, because Chick has such a huge influence on me, direct influence. So it'd be like hanging out with Earl Scruggs, which I also have gotten to do, and it's also, you know. So, I mean, the truth is, I guess I've gotten a little bit more used to being in hot water and being around people that I revere, and it's not as unusual an event as it might be, you know, for someone who that's only happened once with.
Yeah.
But it seems to happen over and over.
Well, that's
good. First, I was such a huge fan of Tony Trischka, and Mark's the guy who told me about him, Mark Horowitz, and then he was my teacher, and then we got to be friends, and then I was friends with a hero. And then I got to be big fans of Sam Bush, and then we became friends, and I still love him. But, you know, he was my hero, and Chick Corea is now my friend.
Oh, yeah.
It's amazing how it happens over and over again, and it's a very it's an amazing life I'm getting to live. I'm very thankful, I know how lucky I am.
It's not accidental. I mean, it's not like you're just walking around and someone says, hey, come here, we need a banjo player. They're looking for somebody who can do and make it work, and but you're doing it so well. It's just nice what you're putting out now. And I hate to use the term body of work, because you know your body is still active and walking around, but you just keep compiling and adding to from the fusion sounds of the Fleck tones, and that's a loose category for me, but I don't know how else to describe it, to the stuff you did with Marcus Roberts, to the stuff you did with Edgar, to the bluegrass stuff that you did, and the Earl Scruggs, and now this concerto. You're putting together a nice little body of work.
Yeah, that's how I'm starting to think, because now I'm in my 50s, so I'm thinking, how much more do I get to do, so I better make sure that everything that I do adds to what I've done, and is a contribution to what I've done, which, you know, it's hard thinking about yourself that way, but I know that if I'm not excited about it and I don't think it's special, I shouldn't be doing it at this point, because, you know, maybe I get to do 15 more projects, I don't know, maybe I don't get 5, who knows? Who knows how, you know, how long I'll get to do this, but I just want to make sure. I'm definitely counting down. I can see, you know, I'm well over half the way through my life and way more than halfway through my career, so I got to be thinking in terms of things that matter.
What was it collaborating with Edgar Meyer and Joshua Bell that made you start thinking about maybe writing a concerto or getting more into that classical vein?
Well, you know, I've always been interested in it, and when I was a kid, my mom... I got together with my stepfather, who's Joe Palladino, who's a classical cellist, not a professional cellist, but a very excellent player. And so I was around classical music, and it was sneaking into my brain at the same time that Earl Scruggs and bluegrass was. So it was always in there as a strain, and probably it even affected the kind of antitunes that I wrote, even though it was unconscious. I never worked on it or studied it. I just heard it around, which is, you know, a good way for kids to integrate ideas. But it wasn't until the 80s when I got to know Edgar, and he was like my first friend who was like, maybe still, who was like an unbelievable classical virtuoso composer. And watching him do his first bass concerto, and not too long after that, I saw Mark O'Connor, who was a peer of mine who also comes from outside of the classical world, doing his first concerto. And then as the years have gone by, you know, I've seen a few other people do it, like Chris Bailey recently did one, and my friend Zakir Hussain, who's another hero of mine who's become a friend, a great Indian musician, did his concerto. And I'm thinking, you know, I've got to do this one day. Everyone I know who I respect has done this. Chick Corea has done it. So it was just a matter of when. And I have to say, it's a much hotter seat doing it yourself than watching your friends do it and saying, oh, he should have done this or he should have done that. When it's you, it's, you know, there's nobody to blame.
Well, what was the tipping point, Bale, that made you decide that now's the time to put this together? How does that click in your brain that I need to do this now?
Well, I'm not exactly sure what the tipping point was, but at a certain point, I had access to the National Symphony, the folks there, and I completed a lot of projects. I completed my second, like Edgar and I wrote a concerto together where basically he was the leader and I supplied a lot of materials and ideas, but he had the master plan, and me and Zakir and Edgar did one together also. And again, I had ideas, but I wasn't driving the boat. And it was to the point where I was getting embarrassed. I hadn't done one myself, and I had something to prove to myself, because after writing with Edgar and with Edgar and Zakir, I felt like, what would I do? How would I do this? What would be different about it? And a lot of times we'd go out and perform these pieces, and people would assume Edgar had written the whole piece. And I definitely contributed in a big way with all kinds of ideas, but I still didn't know that I could do it. So it was a matter of, like, self-respect at a certain point. So I got together for lunch with one of the head people at the Nashville Symphony and asked him whether he thought, you know, I just said there really hasn't been a banjo concerto of note, it would be great. I'd love to be the person to do it. I wonder if you guys would think it was a good idea. And he did. And then, boom, now I was in. I mean, it was an exploratory lunch.
Now you have to do it.
Now, then all of a sudden, there was a lawyer meeting
You say that like it's a bad thing.
Oh, a commission was set up, and there was a deadline, and now all of a sudden it was like, you're doing this. So, you know, be careful what you wish for, because it was a huge job. I loved it, but it was, you know, I thought of nothing else for literally a year.
Wow. Well, and then you had a baby during that year, too, at some point.
Yeah, well, that's 2 years later. So.
Yeah. Oh, that's true. I'm sorry. I'm forgetting that you debuted this, at least a big part of it in Nashville 2 years ago. And was it dedicated to Earl, I think, was it not?
I did, dedicated to Earl. And not only that, he came to the opening, opening night performance. And we have it all on film. So it's going to be all part of this documentary.
Oh, good.
Which is actually going to talk about Earl quite a bit, because I have some special footage of he and myself together playing. And I also have him coming over when I was working on a piece, and I played the piece for him and got his energy. So you know, Earl Scruggs is a very important element of this story, actually.
You know, and he must be someone. And even at the levels that you perform and write and compose and the people that you still, I would bet you that every time okay, bye, Earl, talk to you later, that every time you separated, you must have thought, man, that was Earl Scruggs.
Yeah, absolutely. He lived about a mile from my house, maybe a mile and a half on Franklin Road. And I'd go to see him pretty regularly when I was back in town. You know, I'd take a little time to get reacclimated. If I was here for more than a couple of weeks, I'd go see him. And a lot of the time he was just, at this point in his life, in his last years, he was at home a lot by himself. So I'd bring people over there. And I'm really glad that I did that, that I brought over, just a little while before he passed, I brought over Sam Bush and Pat Enright and Jerry Douglas.
Sounds like the Dreadful Snakes.
And we sat and played. Yeah, and we sat and played. Well, Sam wasn't in the Snakes.
But, oh, okay, you're right.
But everybody else, yeah. And so had a wonderful time with Earl. And so, it's pretty amazing. And actually, one time I was speeding on Franklin Road between our two houses and got pulled over by a cop. And he said, let me see your license. And he went back to his car and came back up and knocked on my window and pulled down the window. And he said, who's the greatest banjo player in the world? And I said, Earl Scruggs. And he said, that's right. Now, don't drive so fast.
You're kidding.
And he gave me back my license.
You're kidding. You beat a speeding ticket on Earl Scruggs.
Yeah, and it absolutely happened. Later I found out that I'm pretty sure that might have been Earl's nephew, but who pulled me over, because there's some Scruggs in the police force. But we had a very warm friendship there for the last few years, and I'm glad it got to that point, because I really didn't know him till the mid-90s when he played on the Bluegrass Sessions album.
Yeah, he was the start of it all.
Yeah, and that's the reason why Earl Scruggs is so special, is because when I was a kid and I heard Earl Scruggs play the Beverly Hillbillies theme, it literally changed my life, stopped me in my tracks, and altered the course of a whole lot of people's futures, but definitely mine.
Wow, well, you're what a dream come true to get to be that level where you can just kind of drive over to Earl the ticket's not just kind of a neat story, but still the fact that you got to meet him and participate in music making with him and just enjoy that and soak it in. Really, there's kind of a factor of just absorbing. It's not all just note for note but it's more like absorbing an attitude or approach, I think, to music, where you can sit with someone like that and kind of understand where they're coming from.
Yeah, and Earl Scruggs, man, he just loves to play and he's very open. And I used to be afraid to play in front of him that he would be put off, because there's so many people who follow Earl Scruggs who are very closed people that see that as a traditional thing that should not be changed. But Earl Scruggs, in fact, played whatever he wanted to at all times and had no problem with people playing around with the music and interpreting it in their own way. And he always enjoyed what I did and would get a kick out of me doing goofy stuff on the banjo. So I know that the master wasn't sitting there going, like Bill Monroe was a different story. He definitely came down on people that didn't do the music the way he wanted to hear it, and he had a very strict idea of how he thought bluegrass should be. But Earl Scruggs is just a different kind of guy, more open guy.
Well, it's funny if you think about the musical changes after the Flat and Scruggs at the end of that. Earl kind of did a lot of different things, went into the southern kind of rock and did different kinds. Seemed like he was always open to new ideas to try to fit him into what he was doing, to the extent that he was exposed to him. I don't think he'd be doing stuff with McCoy Tyner, but within his realm, I think he was very open to new sounds and new music.
Yeah, and I think you'd be surprised if you looked at all the different people that he's collaborated with. I mean, because he's such an icon, people like Sting and Elton John wanted to record with him on Earl Scruggs records.
Wow.
But and I also know there's a famous story of Ravi Shankar coming to Earl Scruggs' house in Nashville and them sitting around and playing.
That's unbelievable.
Ordering fried chicken. So I think he's just an open guy. Now, he had his tastes and he had his Nashville record company that thought he should, record with Elton John or whatever. But those kind of people wanted to record with him too, So it wasn't all about, and for Earl, playing those kinds of pop songs that didn't come from a bluegrass background at all were actually places that he could be pretty creative on the banjo and add his sound to something and put the banjo in a context that had never been heard in before, for instance with Sting or people like that. So there's some creativity to it too.
Wow. Just, he was, the guy was an icon, you say, but living legend, but just almost single-handedly created a new sound from banjos, and everything kind of springs from his appearance and that sound, and all the things that are done now are kind of like still flow from that.
Yeah, and Bill Monroe is a lucky guy that Earl Scruggs showed up. I mean,
yes.
There were some other people coming and picked the time for the five-string banjo, three-finger style was upon us. If it hadn't been Earl, I think it would have been somebody else. But I just think we're very fortunate that it was Earl, because he was such a magnetic musician that it made the whole music so much richer for that to be where it got to start from.
Wow. Hey, let me ask you about, because I happen to know you, I'm in Northern Kentucky. Right before we came on the air, you asked, and I regularly go up to see you. You have a venue just about an hour from where I live in Hamilton, Ohio, that you seem to regularly touch on up at Miami University.
Yeah.
And I know that you're, I can tell you this, I know for a fact that you're coming up there with Abigail, and I think it's October 19th.
Yeah, I think that's right. Is it there or is it in Oxford?
Well, you know what? Take that back. It's one of the venues that's connected with the Miami. There's like three different campuses. It could be the Oxford because I just saw the Flecktones up in Oxford.
I think it might be
Oxford.
Yeah.
But
yeah, I love the both of those venues. And I've come up and played. Howard Epstein is the guy who's brought me up there over and over again, and done me a favor by allowing me to build a community of people that follow me up there.
Oh, you've been there with Newgrass Revival. You've been there with the Bluegrass Sessions. You've been there with the Sparrow. Was it a quartet? I used to be able to count. You did a show, one of my favorite shows of all time. It was you and Tony Trischka, two banjos, and that was all there was on stage.
That's right. Yeah, with the blackboard. Do we have the white?
Yes.
The white
board? Sure. Yeah, you had to do that. That was a blast. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's one of those places that you seem to. And I don't know if it's just proximity or just something that you, but you seem to always have a new project. You brought after the Throwdown My Heart, you assembled some musicians from Africa and took that. Seems like every couple of years when you have something new, that's a place that you always come back to, which I thank you for because it's close to me. But I also think that you're comfortable there with the audience. And I think that you like to go where, you know, people are saying, oh, what's Baylor going to bring back this time? I don't know if you're going to bring the Nashville Symphony Orchestra or not.
Well, that'll be hard because that's an expensive bunch of people to cart around. But, maybe Cincinnati. More likely people would have to come to Cincinnati if that was to happen.
Yeah.
I like going, up till now, I have really enjoyed going out to smaller towns and places where the music is really prized. Because, you can go play in New York City and be all uptight about it. The truth is those people hear amazing stuff. Every night of the week there's amazing music to hear, and everybody's going to be there. But small towns in Iowa or Kentucky or Indiana or wherever off the beaten track, I particularly enjoy those kinds of gigs. And so you could make more money, you could stay off the road and just play the bigger venues, the places where you have a larger audience. But to me, part of what our job is as musicians is to go around and bring the music to people. And live, there's nothing like live.
There's nothing. How many times do we all say that? Go see live music. Go, even if you have every recording that someone's done, it's going to have a different impact on you. They're going to do it a little differently. And the fact that you come to smaller venues, to me, that's where it's at. You go see the great stuff live. Always go out and see live music. I stress that. Everybody does so much. It's just so much different to see it live and experience. It's something you can take home and you can listen to records and CDs, but man, seeing it live is a whole different game.
Yeah, and even more so if you know the records, because nobody's going to play it like the record.
Right.
They're going to play it differently, and every night's going to be different. And if it's possible to follow an artist and hear them do the same, even the same exact show a couple nights in a row or even 6 months in a row, but the same music, and hear how it changes, and part of the change is in you, because as the more you listen to it, the more you understand it. I mean, nobody understood, the Rite of Spring the first time it was heard. It takes a few listenings, and so sometimes opening yourself up to that that process is a great thing for you as a human being, because the first time, like I said, when you hear something the first time, a lot of time, we've all had this experience. You heard it the first time, and then you heard it a while later and you realized how wonderful it was, but the first time it just didn't hit you. And imagine if you never listened to anything more than once.
Yeah.
How many things you wouldn't have the ability to enjoy, because the repeated listenings is the trick. The problem is to know what's worth repeated listening, because you can't do that with everything. And there's so much material out there these days. What are we going to listen to over and over again? And those things reveal themselves to us, but I think it's good to continually find things that you're willing to listen to again and grow into. And I know that works good for me when I'm listening to music. Like when I started listening to Bartok, who is my namesake, I really didn't dig it, and it was just jangly, weird stuff. But now that I keep giving it another chance I'm hearing and it's making sense to me, and I find it to be fantastic. So, you know, first time you heard Coltrane, it might have, you know, been an irritation.
Right.
But, you know, the 15th time, it's a revelation.
Yeah.
So.
I like that. Irritation to whatever you said sounds good to me. I like that.
Revelation.
That's your next. So the music that you're doing with Abigail, then, what I don't want to give away any secrets. Apparently, I already blew the album cover for The Imposter. But what kind of music are you doing with Abigail when you're going to start touring?
That, you know, I'll tell you what the Abigail Layla thing is that we play music together because we love it, because we're a couple, and it's one of the ways that we enjoy each other. And every once in a while, we've had a chance to go out and play. Like, Abby's grandmother asked us to do a benefit at her church, and it was a hit, and people loved it, and we did too. And then there was a time at the Folks Festival, out in Lyons, Colorado, had a dropout, and they heard that Abby and I were in town, asked us if we would fill in for somebody, and we drew a set together, and people loved it again. So, it's like this private thing that we've never really, you know, done professional, serious part of our musical offering, but it's a big part of who we are as a couple. So I just think that at some point we were going to bring it out and start doing it, and the timing works really well for that right now with the new baby, because it's a way that, you know, we won't be apart, and we can go out and do just a few dates together and do some shows together and enjoy that experience, share it with people, and have a baby with us. Take care of them, and neither of us will be out performing somewhere else with someone else during those times, because, you know, for all those reasons. But what the music actually is is more traditional, you know, stuff and arrangements of our songs and arrangements of a few of my tunes. I'll do some solo stuff because the music we do together isn't always the right place for me to show off. So we'll make sure that the people who want to hear me show off are going to hear some of that. It'll be some really soulful, beautiful, simple music that Abby sings and plays and that I improvise along with. And it's the sound of two banjos and a voice. So it's very acoustic, very, very, very warm. She's an incredible performer, way better than I am, with an audience, and makes people feel good. And I just like to go on the ride.
Do you have 5 minutes? I have so many requests. When I announced that you were going to be on, of course, everybody says, play this, but I got the most requests for Cheese Balls in Cowtown. I don't know. Can I play that, and then you stick around, we'll come back, and then we'll wrap it up? I know you got a lot of stuff going on. Is that all right?
Okay, sure.
Okay, all right, let's do that. By the way, if you just tuned in, Bela Fleck calling in Steve Martin's Unreal Bluegrass. I appreciate it. We're going to play a tune, and then I know you came off of an interview earlier in the morning, and you have other stuff to do at your home, and with your family, which is a great thing. But let's play Cheese Balls in Cowtown, then I want to come back and just chat a minute and then let you go on about your way. Okay, man?
Sure.
All right, hold on.
So that was where the name came from. Those years of being in Newgrass Revival in Nashville, I'm seeing the Nashville scene unfold, and, you know, people, you know, trying to make us into country music stars was an odd time, let's just say. And so I didn't love all of it, because a lot of it was just not about music. I'm not talking about the Newgrass guys. I'm just talking about the state of the country music art,
right,
the state of the country music world and what it was all about. Obviously there's always exceptions, and there's always great music that comes out of every idiom, but I wasn't super excited about being affiliated with the Nashville country music scene at a certain point. And so that was the point when I made that record, and it came out of the title. But I actually think the music itself, I when I listen to it, I remember how much I loved a lot of John Hartford's records, and I think I hear some John Hartford influence in that piece.
Okay, hold on a second. All right, I'm with you. Hold on. It says here that I'm unable. Here we go. We're back. There we go. We lost the signal for a second, folks. What we were talking about with Bailey after we came out of Cheese Balls.
Okay. Did you lose me there?
Yeah, we did, but we're back. I just have to watch the monitor, and I noticed that it kicked off right in the middle as you were explaining the Cheese Balls in Cowtown. So
probably the cell phone reception around my house is, of course, the one place where it doesn't work.
Yeah.
I was just saying that that was a time for me when I was part of the Nashville community, and I wasn't real excited about what sort of a the way people approached music in Nashville at that time, especially there was a cookie cutter kind of factory point of view, the way records were being made in the mainstream. And I guess entitling that piece, I was sort of pointing it out. There's a lot of lame stuff that goes on in Nashville regarding music. And that's all.
Okay.
And then the piece itself is influenced somewhat by John Hartford's music, low banjos, a certain kind of groove that I think he would have liked.
Yeah, yeah, he was. You can hear that kind of like a little loping sound throughout it, and just a little bit different. But yeah, everybody wanted to hear Cheese Balls and Cowden. If I hadn't played it, well, then everybody that listens would not have ever listened again. So
I'm glad people like it.
Yeah, they do like it. All right, listen, we're going to wrap up because I know you got stuff to do, but man, I appreciate it so much. Don't be a stranger, please. And after the Secret Concerto comes out, which, you know, nobody knows the album cover of, once you get doing it, I'll tell you what, once you get close to my area in October, and maybe come back on, we'll talk about what you're going to do up in at Oxford in Ohio.
Great. I'd love to do that, man. Thanks for letting me just expound.
Yeah. That's what we do here. Nothing's timed. It's all informal, and I just kind of let people go, and we have a good time and chat till we're done is the way I look at it. So, all right, man. Hey, listen, congratulations on Juno to you and Abigail both, and you're going to enjoy it. It's different, but you're going to enjoy it.
I'll pass that along, and we are enjoying it. And thanks to everybody out there who listens to me and all kinds of music. I appreciate all you guys.
Yeah. Hey, thanks, Bill. I'll talk to you later, man.
Okay.
All right, bye.
So long.
Yep.
Bye.
All right, that was fun. We did lose the signal for a minute. It wasn't his cell phone. It was just the wonders of the internet that kind of vanished on me.